Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton. With me today, we have Lorenzo, who's our director of research for digital assets. We're talking to Carlos Domingo, CEO and co-founder of Securitize. Lorenzo, what does Securitize do? Why is it interesting?
So Securitize is one of the very first tokenization platforms. So what they do is, you know, pretty simple. They are basically issuing native stocks, bonds, and other asset classes on blockchain rails. And so they have, you know, both the broker-dealer license and transfer agent, which is basically, it gives them the ability to have the official record bookkeeping of stocks or bond, for example. And obviously, they also, you know, have this infrastructure in terms of wallets and just L2s, L1, and all the contracts, the piping that you need to build on blockchains to be able to deploy the assets or the safeguards, the authorizations and everything. And so there's Securitize is the main one. There's a couple of other competitors. And today they have about $3 billion of AUM tokenized. And so, yeah, we had a great conversation with Carlos.
Yeah, we're strong supporters of their platform. We think tokenization of real world assets is actually, there's plenty of evidence that it's already exploding, as in, fund issuers are saying, hey, this is an easier way to get our products in front of potential customers and a less expensive way to administer those products. So as an asset manager, you know, it's also interesting from our perspective. Maybe this is a direction we could go in terms of transforming the accessibility of our underlying products. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Carlos. It's a fascinating discussion. Come or stay to learn about the future of tokenization with Securitize. Carlos Domingo, welcome to FYI. You're co-founder, CEO of Securitize. Tell us about Securitize. What do you do? Why do real-world assets need to be tokenized? And what does this mean for the future of finance, please?
Good. So we are, as most people know, a tokenization platform. So we actually take real-world assets, securitize them, or if they're securities already, like stocks, bonds, or funds, and then we put them on chain. And the question you ask is, like, why do you put those things on chain and why tokenization makes sense? But so it's a very simple reason. So if you think about how capital markets work, they basically, every single transaction that happens in capital markets is about updating a ledger, right? So you buy a share of a company, then somebody needs to update the ledger, saying the ownership has changed. You have to pay for it, so the ledger of the cash has to change. You get pay a dividend, so somebody needs to update the ledger, saying that the dividend has been paid and the money has arrived to the investor. You do a redemption of a fund, etc. So everything is about updating ledgers to keep track of ownership. And those ledgers are basically built in very outdated technology. They're siloed, they're not connected with each other. And a lot of the problems in capital markets are about coordinating that these ledgers get updated appropriately, right? So this is why you have long settlement period times. This is why you don't have efficient fractional ownership in some cases. This is why you don't necessarily have 24/7 trading. This is why there's so many intermediaries. There's counterparty risk that you take because things haven't settled, etc. So if you think about what a blockchain is, it's a public distributed ledger technology that is cryptographically secure, that you can always trust the content of it to be trustworthy, and that is programmable. So I can program how updating that ledger happens or doesn't happen, which is important in securities because there are regulations that force whether you can transfer or not a share and things like that. So we do believe that capital markets need to be digitized and upgraded from a technology perspective, and that the best technological foundation for upgrading capital markets is a public blockchain. And essentially, tokenization is about upgrading capital markets and digitize them and getting them ready for, you know, the 21st century. So,
can you help me from like an end user perspective? I think of financial markets as being pretty efficient. I don't know. I buy a stock on Schwab and it seems to me that I've bought the stock. So what does it actually both kind of, does it change that fundamental transaction from an end user perspective, or is it just back into efficiency? And then what are the additional, call it, unlocks that could happen out of tokenization of real world assets?
Sure. First, there's many assets out there, right? So public stocks probably are one of the most efficiently traded assets. And even though there's inefficiencies behind the scenes, an investor is not necessarily exposed to that. But that's not necessarily true international. So first observation is that, you know, we're very spoiled here in the US with all the trading options we have and the good UIs of companies like Robinhood, et cetera. When you go abroad, that's not necessarily true. So I think a blockchain has the potential to make public stocks more accessible internationally for places where these people don't have brokerage accounts, et cetera. And then there's other things you cannot do with the stocks, right? Like, you know, if you want to borrow against, you know, your Apple shares, it's not simple to do it. If you want to trade them 24/7, if you want to transfer them peer-to-peer, I don't know if you ever tried to transfer stocks from a broker-dealer to another broker-dealer. It's like a week process. So when the dividend gets paid, you don't get your money immediately. It takes you like a few days, in some cases weeks, to get the money to you, even though the company has already paid, because they don't know who you are and yet they don't know you're a shareholder, and there's all this web of intermediaries, etc. So there's a lot more inefficiencies in public stocks than people think. But if you start going down the road to other asset classes, alternative assets, etc., then the inefficiencies are even bigger, and then the lack of accessibility is even more exacerbated, right? And tokenization is not just for public stocks. Obviously, public stocks is a massive opportunity, but every single asset class ultimately will be tokenized and upgraded to a better ledger to provide investors with more accessibility, better fractional ownership, more liquidity, more transferability, more lending options, etc.
So give me an example of something Securitize has done, or something Securitize has tokenized that kind of is, yeah, not just a single stock. Like, how has that made a difference?
So our largest asset is a tokenized treasury fund. Tokenized treasury funds exist in traditional finance, but a tokenized treasury fund that runs on crypto rails is basically transferable peer-to-peer across investors 24/7. That's very difficult to do for a private fund in traditional markets. It has on-chain investments and redemptions instantly 24/7. You can pledge it as collateral during the weekend and borrow against it to be able to then trade. So there's a lot of features of essentially how fast it moves and how fast it can, you know, move across investors that are very difficult to do in traditional markets. We also have other options. We have credit funds where you can borrow against them in a simple way and lever them, so you can amplify the yields by recursively lending against the asset, that are pretty much impossible to do in traditional markets. So
I can totally understand, one, the value of this. I can also understand how institutional players or tradition, the incumbents would be not so thrilled about this set of opportunities, because all of the friction that you're talking about is actually the ways in which they make money. The fact that it takes, you know, 3 days to settle, you know, they're making money against that float. You know, all of that friction is actually where the profit centers lie for traditional financial institutions. Why are they even accommodating this? Are they accommodating it? Like, what is the kind of push-pull in terms of like, hey, I have an existing profit center versus this is the future? And how do you navigate that in terms of selling them on actually making the transition to tokenization?
I mean, every disruptive technology displaces incumbents, right? That's what it is. So incumbents are incumbents for a reason. So they're going to try to serve their most valuable customers and neglect maybe the least valuable ones. So, but this is what disruptive technologies are, and this is why the mainframe still exists in some banks, but most people move and use workstations and then PCs and then phones, and slowly but surely these new technologies were taking over the old ones. Also depends on what part of the value chain you play. This is actually advantages, right? So if you think about, you know, an asset manager like BlackRock or Apollo, at the end of the day, what they want is efficiency, right? They want their products to be as efficient as possible, as distributed as possible, as reaching out the hands of as many investors as possible, and then pay less fees to intermediaries. So this is why asset managers are embracing this, and maybe other incumbents that, as you said, their profit centers are disrupted, they're not embracing it. So,
Carlos, you mentioned equities and the traditional markets, like in the US. There's the broker, the clearinghouse, the custodian, like the transfer agent. Like, who keeps the ledger, like on in traditional equities, like in the US? Is like DTCC, like who does what?
That's actually a good question. So the ledger is kept in traditional markets by the transfer agent. Now, okay. What most people don't know is that the clearinghouse actually has all the shares that are currently floating on exchange. They are actually not under the name of the investor. So if you, Lorenzo, go and buy a share in Robinhood, that share is not recorded on the cap table under your name. It's recorded under CD & Co., which is the company owned by DTC that holds all the shares. So they don't have the ledger, but the transfer agent only sees one entry, which is DTC and CD & Co. And then there's a web of, you know, the broker dealer, et cetera, that has, you know, all the tracking to, because you have a claim towards that share that is not actually on your name. But what most people don't know is that you as an investor have the right to actually have the shares under your name on the cap table and move them out of DTC. And that's important because then you're freeing them from the traditional infrastructure. And then if the transfer agent like us uses a blockchain, then you can put it on chain through a token, and then you can let it do things and freely trade in other places, move more efficiently, etc.
You were talking about, you know, borrowing against your securities. I do think like that's a huge unlock. Like today, I've never tried it. What is, if I have like 100K worth of Amazon stock, like how does it work today? Do you go to the bank, and is it like a bespoke process where I want to take out a loan, and they see kind of Amazon stock liquidity, how much you have, like a margin ratio? Like, is that like, I guess, like automated in any way, or is it like fully manual today?
I mean, broker dealers give you like a blanket percentage of your holdings as a margin loan for trading on their broker dealer. It's not that you can take that money and buy a house.
Right.
And then the main issue, to be honest with you, is like, I'll just give you one specific example on how on TradFi in Rails you will do. So suppose you go to JP Morgan and you buy a credit fund, and then you want to go to, let's say, Morgan Stanley and borrow against the JP Morgan fund. You know what the number one problem they have is? They actually don't know how to verify that you actually own the fund. Why? Because the JP Morgan ledger is completely disconnected from the Morgan Stanley ledger. And if you produce a paper saying, I purchased it, they just don't know whether you purchased it, but you've sold it, or whether you've already borrowed against it by somebody else, etc. So the fact that these ledgers are not talking to each other, it's a problem for simple things as the provenance of the asset, like to prove that you own the asset, right? So the number one question for lending is how do you actually make sure that you can prove you own the collateral? And the second thing, which is solved for things like houses, is how do you make sure you're not, you know, rehypothecating the asset? How do you confirm that you pledge something as collateral and is locked somewhere that is visible that you're not actually pledging twice as collateral? And again, the blockchain solves this in a very elegant way because your tokens move from your wallet to a smart contract that holds the collateral and gives you the loan. So these are things that sounds like a, you know, it's almost impossible to do it in real life for us. It's just too complicated to do it. And by the way, institutions actually have ways to get around this, right? Because they are institutions. They have a lot of people, they move a lot of money, so the banks will go the extra leg for doing it. But if you are like an individual investor and you want to buy $100,000 of a credit fund and borrow $50,000 against it to buy a car, then it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, I think one way to interpret financial innovation generally and the specific promise of public blockchains against traditional financial assets is financial innovations are mechanisms that allow individuals to get wholesale pricing for financial risk transformation. So even if you go back to mortgage securitization, it's basically like the individual borrower wasn't getting the same rate as the giant company that was going to the bond market. But by securitizing the mortgage and bundling them together, you got to treat them as kind of like equal size kind of securities for bond offerings. And so it collapsed the rate of borrow for individuals. And the same thing should happen here, where, like you're saying, the fixed cost of kind of like underwriting a collateral asset that somebody wants to borrow against collapses with blockchain. So a small borrower can, you know, prove that they own that credit fund, and so then pledge it as collateral in an easy way. And even when it's like really big things, like the banks screw up sometimes. Like the First Brand's bankruptcy was basically like
collateral pledged multiple times to
because they couldn't track the rehypothecation. So this is a very good analogy, which I really love, because in some sense, this is like, if you think about what the iPhone did, is it basically put a computer on the hands of billions of people that didn't have computers, right? So I think that, you know, tokenization is a force of democratization access to financial services products that are not accessible to the everyday people, because it's just so inefficient to do it, nobody cares about. Like, I have a wealth management account, and every time I want to do something, it's a complete nightmare, because they will not even pay attention to me. Why? Because, you know, I'm under the threshold of somebody profitable for them, because I don't have enough money. So, and then because the whole process is manual, you can't do anything by yourself, and everything requires people involved and manual processes, etc. If you're under a certain threshold, they won't even serve you. And this is also why they have very high minimums for investments, because if you invest $5,000 on something that requires three people being involved, it's unprofitable. If you invest $5 million, that is profitable. So, but then if you only have $5,000, you just don't have access to the asset class. And this is, by the way, more exacerbated in other countries than here. So yeah, I see this as the big democratizing factor for finance blockchain.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing from a U.S. market perspective. It's easy to underestimate how much friction there is in accessing some of these services in other markets. Or even, you mentioned it, like if you live in Latin America and you're trying to buy a U.S. stock, certainly as an individual, that's much more difficult to do than it is for, you know, me, the individual in the U.S. And so in some ways, there's a promise and a threat here that it makes capital able to flow internationally more frictionlessly, which means that you could have some of the home country bias around stock market investment actually fall out, because there will be less friction to get access to U.S. equities or any equity from any country.
I think stable coins have proof that there is a worldwide appetite for dollars, right? Because it's a safe currency. I do believe the same appetite for, you know, stocks exist. It's just that it's not available. So once the same way that tokenized dollars have exploded to $300 billion and they're available worldwide, and a lot of people in emerging markets are consuming dollars, once we start tokenizing stocks and other financial products coming from the US, there will be a massive demand coming from emerging markets. And by the way, the technology can actually eliminate the regulatory friction of having to comply with different rules in different places, right? Because that's what smart contracts and rule-based software, et cetera, takes care of it.
There's obviously, for equities and bonds, it's an asset class that is available to retail and institutions right now, like pretty easily, like in the US. So obviously you can bring down the cost, you know, make it more programmable, more features. How do you think about asset classes that are completely illiquid, right? Like private equity, venture capital. Do you think that is tokenization, like, is actually like a really good fit here to make it liquid somehow?
So that's a good question. I think it's a combination of technology and regulation, right? So tokenization, what makes it something easier to trade, right? Because it's easier to trade it, it's easier to move it, it's easier to settle a trade, and that leads to probably better price discovery. There's still a regulatory component of making sure there is enough buyers and sellers and that those products are actually available for retail people. And then I think the reason why most, you know, of these assets are not available for retail people is just because it's a complete headache, as Brett was saying, to serve an individual investor, right? So they focus only on institutions. Institutions can deal with the inefficiency. So as this technology percolates and allows, you know, people to have a VC. I mean, you guys have Ark Ventures, a great example, right? You can take a $500 ticket, right? But then you just have to deal with, you know, all these people. Like, suppose one day you pay a dividend. Like, if you have a dividend distribution that you need to send it to 100,000 holders, and like, unless I have an efficient mechanism to deal with that, or a redemption window, etc., then it becomes a problem, right? So most asset managers don't want to do what you guys did of going through the process of registering a fund, because they don't see it as an advantage. They see it as a headache. So I think this technology will ultimately, you know, eliminate this headache, if you want. And asset managers will want to have their products in the hands of retail people, and that will then make them have bigger number of holders and making them more liquid. And keep in mind that most people don't realize that in the US, there is, you know, 15 million people that are accredited investors. Forget about pure retail, but accredited investors, because from a regulatory perspective, it's easier to sell things to accredited investors. These 15 million people, collectively, they hold like around $70 trillion in wealth. And only the top of a pyramid of these 15 million people access those products. The rest, the only alternative asset they buy is actually crypto, probably, because it's very accessible.
Right.
But they don't buy a credit fund, or they don't buy a VC fund, or they don't do all any of those things.
It occurs to me that tokenization could be, like, if you imagine the emerging market, there's clearly a demand for dollars in emerging markets. And then there's demand for some kind of equity like exposure. And people have only basically been able to go into Bitcoin and maybe Ethereum and others. And so tokenization of traditional assets may actually be in a strange kind of way, like competitive against kind of the marginal flows into the pure crypto assets, where it's like, well, now you don't just get the equivalent of digital gold. You get the actual, you know, digital ownership right of a real, you know, company generating real cash flow, and you have a command on that cash flow that'll get paid out to you. It's kind of an interesting, you know, the finance eating up kind of blockchains in a way, or actually the promise of really these smart contracting protocols is to take all of these wonderful financial instruments and make them broadly available. How does Securitize actually do that? And can you distinguish between kind of like the direction that you all are doing, which is kind of like, I am taking an asset and I'm directly tokenizing it, versus there's a whole nother collection of actions of like, I'm pointing at an asset, I'm creating a derivative off of that without necessarily even having permission on the underlying asset.
So first, I think that the one thing shouldn't take from the other, right? There's $4.5 trillion of digital wallets out there that could become bigger if they have options to consume other assets that are maybe less volatile, that have a cash flow, as you mentioned, generates. Like, people hold dollars, but what about if they could hold treasuries that give you a 4% yield and you can move them back and forth to dollars anytime you need to pay 24/7 on chain, etc.? Is that going to make less tokenized dollars, or is it going to make people put more money on digital wallets and enlarge the pie, right? And in terms of the tokenization approach, we are issuer-led, what we say. So we will work with the company that wants to tokenize something to make sure we do it with their permission, and we do it in a way that the token represents exactly the same rights as the underlying security. There's no counterparty risk towards us. There's no derivatives. There's no price trackers or things like that. I think that those are shortcuts to maybe try to get things done quickly, but that ultimately, you know, these derivatives, you know, are not the same thing, right? So once you have, you know, five different derivatives of tokenized Tesla, they're not compatible with each other, they're not fungible, etc. And one day Tesla tokenized their own stock, and the token is the real stock, those will disappear. So it's just, I think people are being a bit lazy, if you want, instead of doing the hard work of going asset by asset and issuer by issuer, and then try to tokenize it properly.
Play that scenario out, as in there's five different versions of tokenized Tesla, all of which are trying to trace to the underlying stock. And then there's the official tokenization event. What happens to the holders of those derivatives in that circumstance, do you think?
They will sell it and buy the real thing. Why would you not do that?
So
I
then,
mean, if you're holding a derivative of a Tesla that, you know, doesn't actually give you the same rights as the underlying, and that doesn't necessarily track the price appropriately because it's not the same thing. So it doesn't actually need to have the same price, right? Because you're not buying the same thing. And then you have the real, you know, native tokenization of, let's say, Tesla equity. You know, naturally, the volume will migrate towards the real thing because there is no downside, but there's only advantages and upside.
So then suddenly you're at risk of whatever mechanism was used to create it. You're trying to redeem to, like, transfer into the real thing. And there's somebody on the hook for that redemption. Like, there's somebody's balance sheet that's ostensibly supporting that.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because in many cases, these assets, when you buy them, you don't even have redemption capabilities.
Right.
Because so I don't know what's going to happen. That's why, by the way, I believe that these things are not taking off, because people don't even know what they're buying or what happens if they're going to be left holding the bag when people suddenly don't want the asset. Because, you know, these are tokens that are, in many cases, permissionless and no KYC. I mean, they don't even know who you are when you hold it. Like, how are they going to even pay you a dividend in a legal way if there's a dividend distribution, or if you need to participate on a proxy vote? Like, they don't even know your identity. So how are they going to let you vote? So those are very risky assets that I think people are taking shortcuts to try to regain the narrative towards tokenization. But ultimately, the native tokenization is what will prevail in the industry.
Carlos, to tokenize stocks, for example, like, just for our listeners, if you guys want to tokenize NVIDIA or Tesla, for example, like, do you need to go separately to Elon, to Jensen, like to the companies and basically,
I don't know if it...
not them, but you know what I mean? Like, and basically, hey, we want to do like another, you know, bookkeeping entry. Like how scalable it is, my question.
But look, is this the same thing when NASDAQ wants to list a share, right? They have to go to the company and the company needs to agree to be listed there. So yes, you have to go one by one, but this is a flying wheel, right? Like maybe at the beginning you get one or two, and then you get 10, and then from 10 you go to 100, and from 100 you go to 1,000. And as people, and this ultimately becomes what every single company will do it, right? So it's, then it's not a problem anymore, because every company will want to have a tokenized version of their equity alongside maybe the traditional one that they still keep trading in traditional markets. So yes, it's more work at the beginning, but it's more reward at the end. And then you're not misleading investors, telling them you're buying a tokenized Tesla when you're not buying a tokenized Tesla, you're buying a tokenized something else.
Give us one layer deeper on how you do the actual work. What is the work that Securitize actually has to do in order to not take shortcuts and do it the right way?
So we are an SEC registered transfer agent. That's a license that maybe most people have never heard of, but it is actually an official, you know, regulated entity under the SEC that can work with an issuer to basically manage their cap table. So the transfer agent is typically responsible to, you know who holds what and conduct all the asset servicing related to the company. Like, you know, make sure if there's a proxy vote, you know who the holders are and you conduct the proxy vote. If there's a dividend distribution, you do it. If it's a stock split, like that's the role of the transfer agent. Now, the problem is those transfer agents, they use, you know, most of the traditional ones use outdated technology. So it's end up being a clunky experience. And sometimes, you know, obviously all these efficiencies of the blockchain are not there. So now we registered as a transfer agent in 2019. With the SEC, we were the first company that registered as a transfer agent, telling the SEC, and by the way, our ledger technology is this thing called Ethereum. That's how we started in 2019. And that's where we're going to put our securities. And then for many years, we've operated under the assumption and had a lot of discussions back and forth with the SEC, telling them, look, we're, you know, regulators are technology agnostic. As far as we comply with all the customer protections and all the regulatory obligations that we have as a transfer agent, you should let us use whatever technology we want to keep track of those things. And then ultimately now, you know, after the change in the administration in the US and the appointment of Paul Atkins as the chairman of the SEC and the creation of the crypto task force, the SEC has publicly acknowledged and publicized that as a transfer agent, you can use a public blockchain as your underlying ledger technology, which is great because it's something that we've been operating under that assumption, but with some degree of regulatory uncertainty. So that's the trick, right? So if you want, of course, there's a lot of like complexity as transfer agents are complex entities and, you know, issuing tokens on the blockchain have to be issued in a way that you maintain the regulatory, you know, structure of the security and control transfers with the smart contracts and be able to do asset servicing, etc. But essentially, it's just simple as saying, as a transfer agent, I just use this better ledger technology and that's where I put my securities.
And so since the administration changed over and there's clearly been a change in kind of the political or even the implicit like understanding of whether or not this is useful technology that is going to be regulatorily accepted, has that changed your conversations with issuers and institutions?
100%, because there is no regulatory risk. I have to say that some asset managers that have been our customers since years ago, like, you know, Hamilton Lane and BlackRock and early last year, Apollo, etc. They did their own due diligence of us and the regulatory, and they felt comfortable enough that this was okay to be able to start tokenization. But now that conversation is not even there because you can just point to the SEC website and say, just read this note. They are saying tokenization is good. It's fine. Transfer agents can use public blockchains. Broker dealers can do custody of tokenized securities, etc. So the conversation has accelerated significantly in terms of the amount of explanations you need to give to somebody to convince them that this is okay.
And for us as an asset manager, it's like just getting a listed on various platforms or for, you know, our venture fund, getting somebody to actually allow it to happen because there's such a high fixed cost for it is a battle, right? And the promise here for a fund manager is once it's tokenized, essentially, it becomes much more portable, not just for the end user, but also for any platform that wants to effectively host it, right?
That's correct. I mean, people, I mean, you can digitize the fund, right? Like you can have a digital experience of purchasing a registered fund like the ones you guys have, and it's great. But then those securities are locked on that platform, right? When you tokenize, you're basically putting them on a public ledger. So anybody could potentially integrate with them for distribution. Anybody could create like a lending protocol so I can borrow against them. Everybody could create like an on-chain, you know, trading facility for those shares. And that's the beauty of public infrastructure, right? So if you think about like internet as a simil, when I started on accessing internet, you have American Online and MSM, and they were like closed ecosystems, right? And then the open internet came, and that's where innovation happened, right? Because it was built on open protocols. Anybody could build anything they wanted to and talk to each other, and the protocols were open and connecting. So this is the same thing. Like, you know, the main difference, people are sometimes asking, oh, well, we already can buy like digital shares on this platform. I don't want to mention names. It's like, sure, but then nobody's going to build anything innovative around what you can do with those securities because they are trapped there. When it's built on open protocols that anybody can interact with, this is when innovation happens, right? So I believe this is the, like, we'll be talking 2 or 3 years from now, and people will have come up with ideas about what to do with tokenized securities that you and I cannot think about today, because that's the beauty of an open platform where people can, you know, participate, you know, freely.
What role can you guys have on IPOs? I was looking the other day, like at Just Capital Formation, for the Bullish IPO, which, you know, we participated, we're investors. They received, I think, a good chunk in stablecoins for the IPO funding, which was really interesting. Do you think we're going to get to the point where, you know, for the IPO, there is going to be actually, you know, on-chain kind of issued shares? Obviously, that goes mainly to institutions, not for retail. But do you think, you know, it's an interesting market there? Or are you guys talking to companies looking to do this?
Everybody is very excited about that. And I do believe the same way that, of course, institutional allocation is not going to disappear, right? Like, look, these things don't happen overnight and you don't displace incumbency overnight. But the same way that you guys are also investors in Robinhood. Robinhood started doing IPO allocations for their users like me, right? And then now that has become kind of like a norm. Like every company doing an IPO that has a retail name allocates like whatever, 5% of 10% share of the shares for the retail people through, you know, Robinhood or SoFi or other platforms. So I do believe that in the near future, companies will still IPO in traditional markets because at the end of the day, you know, large institutional investors are not going to adopt new technology quickly the same way that banks didn't abandon mainframes and move to PCs. That's not going to happen overnight. But the same way that you have today, like a 5 or 10% allocation for the retail crowd through these retail broker dealers, you're going to have the 5 to 10% allocation to the tokenized version of the stock that will get distributed to digital wallets for the people consuming crypto. I'm totally convinced it's going to happen. I just don't think that people will IPO only on chain.
Right.
Unless they're like maybe smaller companies that they're looking to raise less money. There is exemptions in the US like Reg A Plus where you can raise up to $75 million from retail, etc. But if you want to do like a full-blown IPO and raise $1 billion, what you're going to do is go allocate a chunk to institutions in traditional ways and then allocate a portion retail and retail broker dealers and a portion on tokenized format.
Speaking of listing, you just announced, you know, today as of this recording.
Today, actually.
today, yeah, as of this recording that you're going to list on the NASDAQ. Talk about kind of like Securitize's both strategy in doing so and what you see happening with Securitize on a go-forward basis.
So look, for us, we're going to become 8 years old next month in November 2025. We started in November 2017. So it's been a very long journey where, you know, it took a very long time for this part of the industry to get traction and take off. And it has really happened the last couple of years. And part of what we do is to have the trust of our customers, right? Because our customers are the largest, you know, financial services companies in the world. So going public is a way for our credibility to our company, to our brand, to get more exposure out there of what we do, etc. So we are profitable. We've been growing tremendously. Now the numbers are public, so I guess I can see them, but we've been doing like 9 times revenue in the last 18 months, profitable for 2 quarters, etc. So we thought that this was a very good opportunity to go public. We decided to do it together with Cantor as a de-SPAC transaction. So we're merging with their with Cantor Equity Partners too, which is already publicly traded. And then obviously we're going to also tokenize the SPAC and subsequently our stock, because I think we should be the first ones consuming our own technology and showcasing what people can do with this, which was another good reason to go public.
People generally, me too, we like to operate by analogy. How do I think about Securitize within the future kind of capital market stack? Like, what is the analogous spot that you're holding relative to kind of another traditional financial institution? Or is it impossible, or is it like splaying across multiples?
It's spread across few, but I would say you should think of us as the bridge between TradFi and crypto. We're a service provider for people that have securities. We're not an asset manager. We don't originate our own assets. We always work with issuers, whether issuers of public stocks, bonds, funds, etc. And then we are a service provider. What other services providers that people use there will be companies like, I don't know, State Street or BNY or some of the traditional providers. They're not the same. Some of them are banks. Some of them are custodians. We're not custodian. We're a transfer agent, but we're also a broker dealer, et cetera. So it's hard to like place us exactly, but you should think of us as, you know, a modern version of a service providers that basically helps asset issuers to basically manage their securities and distribute them.
And at a very high level, like you make money off of things converting from traditional financial into tokenized assets. So as if you have like, I mean, our estimate is we think there's $1 quadrillion by 2030 in financial assets in the economy, and those are going to kind of flow over into becoming tokenized assets. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to happen in large scale because that's such a large volume of money out there. But even at a slow adoption rate, you end up with literally trillions of dollars getting tokenized over time. And you facilitate that transformation, the transfiguration.
Correct. So we currently manage $4.6 billion of tokenized assets on chain. The low end of those projections is that the total size of tokenized assets is going to be around $2 trillion. And today we command like around 20-25% market share of the entire market, which is small, is like 30 billion plus. But we're the largest platform and the highest market share, not just overall, but also in most of the individual categories. So if the market goes to $2 trillion, and we reduce our market share to 10%, which is probably what's going to happen, right? Because there's so many different asset classes you want to tokenize, geographies. Is this not a market where you have a service provider taking 90% market share? So let's say we do 10% and the market goes to $2 trillion, we're going to manage $200 billion. So 4.6 billion or close to 5 to 200, you know, do the math. That's the potential growth of our company in the future. Not doing very well, just basically reducing market share. So this is why this is very exciting. This is why we should go and be public and get a strong balance sheet and gain more credibility. Use that money also to see what other pieces of the puzzle we're missing that we need to consolidate. Look about what can we do internationally in terms of, you know, getting other licenses in other jurisdictions, etc. So it's very exciting.
We just had a podcast with Sandeep, like the founder of Polygon, Carlos. So maybe
I know him very well, and he's a great guy. And they've been a big supporter of us over the years.
And we were talking about this, like right now, you know, in the blockchain space, you basically have like three big players, the asset issuers, you know, or tokenized, like you guys, Circle, issuing assets kind of on chain, the platforms, which are really the protocols like the Aave's, you know, the Uniswaps are also like Robinhood, the platform. And then you have the networks underneath, right? Like the L1s or the L2s. Mm-hmm. We're always, I mean, internally with Kathy and the team, I was like, where is kind of value going to accrue, right? To which of these three or how, you know, how? It does seem like in the last months, some of the issuers or even the platforms are launching their own network, right? Like you guys have announced with Athena, like Converge. We have Stripe with Temple, Arc, you know, with Circle. How are you guys thinking about this? Like, is it important to have their own like network or not really? Like, how are you guys thinking about this?
I mean, we're participating in multiple like on-chain projects. We obviously worked with Polygon very early on. The tokenization of our products with Hamilton Lane started there. But before we had worked with Avalanche, we obviously started on Ethereum. We support Solana. We're working in different projects. We're excited about these new launches. I think that from us, irrespective of whether we more actively participate or not on any specific blockchain project, we need to be blockchain agnostic. Because at the end of the day, we are a service provider for an asset manager. So if an asset, I can't force an asset manager to put their assets on my chain just because that accrues more value to me. That will not be the right thing to do. Is it better to be more integrated with some chains where you can actually potentially accrue more value? Certainly, yes, but you shouldn't force, and at least in our view of the situation, we also have a partnership with Wormhole to be able to move assets across chains. So all of our assets are integrated that way, et cetera. And look, if you asked me a few years ago, I would have thought that this is going to collapse into like two or three chains maybe. And it seems to be going in the opposite direction, that we're going to have 30 right. chains. And what I hope is that somebody fixes the UX issue of moving across right. chains, because that's becoming problematic. As a crypto user as well, myself, it's just like a bit of a mess when you have so many chains, and we need to figure out how to abstract this out. And certainly we think there is enough value to accrue in our part of the value chain. Obviously, not all the value is going to accrue there. But we, I mean, our revenue numbers are not public. So, you know, we make good enough revenue. We're profitable, et cetera. So there is no shortage of value to be accruing our part of the value chain. And by the way, we also need the other parts. Right? We also work actively with Aave on integrating for Lendi on this their new Horizon RWA marketplace. We obviously need somebody to build the L1 or L2 infrastructure. We also need platforms like Robinhood or trading platforms to distribute, et cetera. So
there's always this cycle where suddenly people are talking about private blockchains, or like everybody watches their own L1.
Hopefully private blockchains will disappear now, because I think that's more or less a glorified database and nothing particularly useful to anybody.
Right. Well, right. But I mean, how much difference is there between some of these L1s and private blockchains? I don't know. Like, I think there will be a winnowing.
I mean, they're managed privately, but at least they're open to anybody to interact with them, right? Like, you know, we've integrated with private blockchains of banks in the past, and it's a very painful process that is not open to anybody. Or like even just connecting through a VPN to the data center to be able to issue assets, it's a whole process. So I think these chains are somewhat private in the way they're being created and managed, but they're open for anybody to use them, right? Or to issue their assets. Like Lorenzo was asking me, are you going to deploy assets on Tempo? I don't know. We've just started talking to them, but I actually can do that without talking to them, right?
Right.
So if I wanted to. So.
And maybe that's the, permissionless means like not just permissionless transactions, but also permissionless building on top of something that somebody else has deployed.
Correct. They are open infrastructure, right? I mean, they're maybe privately managed in the sense of how they run the validators or how they've been built, et cetera, but the platform itself is open. So
5 years forward, what does Securitize look like? What does success look like for you? And is there a specific category that you're aiming to like really kind of occupy in the space or unknown?
So for us, AUM is always the North Star, right? Because if we grow our AUM, means the rest of the industry is growing and we're sustaining a healthy market share. And if you ask me 2 years ago, at the beginning of 2024, we had 200 million in AUM. So my North Star is I'm going to get to a billion. Now we're about to get to 5 billion. So my next North Star is 10 billion next year, which will more than double our assets. But I think that 5 years from now, I want to be above 100 million. Because that means if there's 100 billion tokenized by us, it means out there, there's probably a trillion plus. And that means tokenization is here to stay. And there's a point, at that point in time, people will start talking about tokenized assets and we'll talk about financial assets. The same way that people stop putting .com in their companies or saying you're an internet company and you're just a company. So I think that's the ultimate, moment where this technology has become transparent enough that people are just using for everything. And then it goes and becomes 100 times bigger than it is now. And then in terms of asset classes, look, I mean, one of the issues with tokenization for us in particular over the years, having been around for a long time, is that, everything can be tokenized, right? But every asset class has its own, a specific problem of how you tokenize it and also what problem you're actually solving, right? So we don't want to try to tokenize everything. I think that there's kind of three categories where we think there is enough potential for us to continue growing in the next few years, where we have a leadership position already. I think treasuries are just the beginning. I mean, there's only $8 billion of tokenized treasuries and there's $200 billion of tokenized dollars. That makes no sense. Tokenized treasuries should eventually become bigger than tokenized dollars because that's what it is on traditional markets. So treasuries, we continue being extremely excited. We have the largest asset with BlackRock. We also have a partnership with VanEck for another slightly different product. The Genius Act allows for tokenized treasuries for stable coins, and I believe we'll see a proliferation of stable coins happening in the future, etc. So treasuries, I'm very excited about it. Then yield-bearing assets are very interesting, right? Because crypto people are used to like yield generation, and a lot of protocols, lending, etc. They've been designed with yield-bearing assets in mind to generate extra yield or to lever the assets. And I think that yield-bearing assets are very interesting, which is something most retail people don't think about, or like people don't think about. I'm going to buy this because it yields 9% and lever it to make 15. And because as you said, Brett, this is something that large institutions do, retail people don't do that. So I think that category itself, which has a number of different products, credit, CLOs, bonds, etc., is still there's a lot of room to explore and do things there. And the third one is the one we discussed, tokenized public equities. I think that that's a category that, in my opinion, doesn't exist, because I don't count those derivative products as actually the real thing. But, you know, I think it will come, and when it comes and it happens, and it will happen slowly, and then at some point it will explode, and every single company will have a version of their shares natively tokenized on a blockchain.
One last question, Carlos. What about real estate? Real estate, I feel like in crypto, has always been this kind of elusive, you know, asset class that we're going to bring on chain. It's going to be liquid. It's never worked, literally. It's this massive asset class. Like, do you think that will come on chain at some point?
At some point, everything will come on chain, right? So, but if you ask me, are you going to hire 10 people to go after tokenized real estate tomorrow? The answer is no.
No.
Okay. I think that we're still, first, real estate is very difficult for people to understand. Like if you tell people, look, I'm going to give you an asset from a reputable asset manager that yields 9%, everybody understands that. Real estate is very difficult to measure. I think that there's going to be the first interesting tokenization projects for real estate will be trophy assets. Not tokenizing I remember back in when I started the company, it was one of our competitors that announced a project of tokenizing a student dormitory in North Dakota. Like, nobody cares about that. Now, if you bring a very big trophy asset that gets tokenized, that gives fractional ownership to retail people, et cetera, that might be exciting. And I will definitely would like to participate on those kind of projects. But broadly, tokenization of real estate, thinking that just because you tokenize it, you're going to make it liquid, I think it will still take some time to go. I think we will first see some trophy assets, very well known, that retail people will recognize and will say, I want to own a piece of this. Those will be the first ones that will come on chain at scale.
Yeah, I think real estate is already a heavily levered asset. Part of the reason people own real estate is because banks accept it as collateral to lend against, because they have underwriting processes for it. One of the promises of tokenization is, hey, there's all these other assets that actually you should be able to get leverage against, but you actually within traditional financial ecosystems, you can't really efficiently do it. And so then it seems like real estate, since it's already levered, like at least that reason to tokenize doesn't necessarily exist anymore.
Yeah, and that's why I don't think that people will be tokenizing my house, right? This makes no sense. I think if you see real estate tokenization, you will see the other opposite. So going back to what you said, Brett, about bringing down to retail what only institutions have access, you're going to get a very large, well-known property that retail people don't have access to that gets tokenized to give retail people access to, own a piece of that property.
Well, Carlos, it's really been educational, and we're happy to be on the journey with you. I think that
I'm very glad that you guys came on board and looking at tokenizing things with you guys.
Yes, for sure, for sure. So we look forward to hearing more from you in the future and more from tokenization. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.